Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to regard, over the many, many shows in 2019, as well as previous years, in which we had the privilege of speaking with David Goldman, him as one of our great national treasures, a Renaissance man with command of all kinds of interesting topics, from finance to geostrategy to innovation and industrial policy to musicology, among other things. David Goldman is a fabulous contributor to this program. We're delighted to have him back in 2020 and to talk with us about a couple of things in two segments today that are very much in the breaking news department. And it's a privilege to be able to take stock with him as they're breaking. He is, among other things, of course, known for his fabulous columns at Asia Times under the byline Spengler. He is the author of How Civilizations Die, and he is welcome, as always, here in 2020. David, I want to say a particular welcome to talk us through this so-called Phase 1 agreement that was signed yesterday at the White House with the communist Chinese. Welcome in. What did you make of it?
I think it's a tactical victory for Trump. It will help him in the elections. It will certainly help American farmers. He's also persuaded the Chinese to agree to a procedure for monitoring technology theft and forced technology transfer, which takes the issue out of the World Trade Organization, which is a completely useless entity, which takes years to do anything, and creates a very speedy process where the United States can immediately establish that the Chinese are violating their agreement. So it really holds China's feet to the fire on certain issues. To the extent it addresses those limited issues, I think the Trump administration and the Trade Representative Lighthizer did a good job, and Trump can go to the American people and say, I've brought something back which is good for you. So I think it has limited but positive implications. Chinese have had to accept the fact that we're keeping tariffs in place, which is a way of really keeping a gun to their head to ensure compliance. Earlier, the Chinese have said, we'll never accept an inequitable agreement which does not remove the tariffs, and they were forced to accept Trump's terms. So the Chinese have made an important concession. So I'd score this as a modest but positive victory.
David, a key piece of evaluating it, of course, is it likely to be adhered to by the Chinese? You've studied them closely over many years, and I think probably understand better than most what their track record of compliance with their commitments has been. When you talk about enforcement, in part, that depends upon whether they'll even adhere to the mechanics of the deal, let alone the terms. Do you anticipate that this will be a different performance record going forward than we've seen in the past from the Chinese?
I think a fundamental change has occurred in the past 36 months in China, which is a shift from dependence on stealing technology to a new confidence in their ability to develop and deploy their own technology. The most extraordinary thing is that at the end of 2018, Huawei came out with its own chipsets for its own phone. If you recall, when ZTE was caught red-handed violating Iran sanctions, the U.S. administration in April of 2018, I believe, shut off exports of American chips to ZTE, which produces handsets. That shut the company down. Only 6 months later, Huawei announced that it was self-sufficient in chips, and it can now produce smartphones and 5G base stations with zero U.S. components. Now, there's a bigger issue about whether some of the foreign components they're buying have American content and whether we have any leverage there. But nonetheless, China has made a gigantic effort to achieve self-sufficiency in the technologies which most matter to them. And I think they will emphasize their own internal innovation as opposed to stealing from us. That's not good for us because it means that they've moved to the point where they're less dependent on us than they have been in the past. The second thing, which is very hard to monitor, is the voluntary technology transfer on the part of American companies. The American tech companies, Google, for example, are very eager to get into the Chinese market. The Chinese in the past demanded joint ventures with a formal technology transfer as the price of doing that. They will stop doing that, or if they don't, they're going to get slapped because they'd be violating the terms of the agreement in an egregious and obvious way. But that doesn't prevent a lot of our companies who are perfectly happy voluntarily to transfer technology to the Chinese to do so voluntarily. And our ability to control private sector decisions to transfer technology is still quite limited. So a lot can go under the table because the U.S. business community is acting on behalf of their stock price and not national security.
We're going to have a further conversation about that topic with Roger Robinson in the latter part of the program. So I appreciate you putting the marker down. This may bear the effect of the agreement, aside from the efforts of the Chinese to comply with it or not comply with it. Let me ask you about a particular topic that I know is top of mind for you. You mentioned Chinese innovation. You've also been a champion of the need for far greater commitment to innovation in our own country, the competitiveness necessity for national security as well as commercial reasons being a prime consideration. Senator Marco Rubio has recently, I think since we last spoke, come up on the net in a similar vein. Just very quickly, David, your thoughts on how that has to feature into a post-phase one environment.
I think it's become clear to many people that hitting a Chinese over the knuckles is not sufficient to assure American technological dominance. We've had very little success, for example, with most of the world in persuading even our closest allies not to use Huawei equipment. And that's been a major public commitment on the part of the Trump administration. Even the Daily Telegraph, which is the main conservative newspaper in England, is predicting that Britain will, in fact, let Huawei in to a limited extent, despite the urgent pleas of the Trump administration. That would be quite a blow to us. I think it would be very different if we told the world, we are going to dominate broadband technology. We're going to spend whatever amount of money it takes. We want a global effort, including our closest friends like the British and the Koreans, to provide an alternative to China. And if you don't jump on the bandwagon with us, you'll be left behind. At that point, I think the whole world would sign up with us in a heartbeat. A bill just went through the Senate proposing $1 billion worth of subsidies over a number of years to American companies engaged in 5G. That's in the right direction, but it's a baby step. Huawei, with an expenditure of $20 billion a year in R&D, mostly spent, by the way, hiring foreign engineers operating in 22 research centers around the world, now dominates the technology.
I know this is a subject of your forthcoming book, and we are very anxious to see it. David, we're going to have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with David Goldman and take a look at several other very important parts of the world that are also in the news at the moment, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with the great David Goldman to talk a bit about how civilizations die, I guess is sort of the larger rubric, but also how this nation is going to have to take steps to protect itself in various ways and in various parts of the world against the existential threat of our time, as I see it, and that is the Chinese Communist Party. David, you have been following closely for quite some time, of course, developments in Asia, the subject of many of your columns in Asia Times. There was a remarkable development this weekend in Taiwan, and I'd be very interested in both your assessment of what happened there and why, and what is likely to come next on the island and perhaps elsewhere in the vicinity.
Well, Prime Minister Chai's party won a landslide election. This is a party which wants to maintain Taiwan's democracy against Beijing. It will not take an overt position of declaring independence because that could be a casus belli with the Chinese. But it is a considerable embarrassment to Beijing. Beijing has a problem. They want Taiwan to be part of China. Their position is Taiwan is a rebel province. And they've managed to persuade the whole world to accept a one-China policy. But on the other hand, Taiwan is a vibrant democracy. The Taiwanese want to be a democracy. And Beijing can't have its cake and eat it too. They're going to have to accept a challenge to the credibility of the Chinese authoritarian system in a Chinese province, short of invading, which I don't think they want to do. On the other hand, I wouldn't exaggerate the likelihood of Taiwan moving away from China. First thing that happened when the United States last spring cut off the export of American high-tech components to Huawei is that Huawei went to dozens of Chinese companies who had been lined up at their door begging for Huawei's business and started buying components from Taiwan. 10% of all of Taiwan's semiconductor engineers are now working at double salary in mainland China, helping to build up China's internal semiconductor industry. So economic relations between Taiwan and mainland China are now tighter than they ever have been in the past. So neither side wants to destabilize that. Beijing, I think, is going to have to understand that liberalization is inevitable if they want to avoid a complete crack-up. And the Taiwan is a signal for that. This is very difficult for Xi, and he'll manage it by prevaricating, obfuscating, and trying to postpone the problem. But it really does put a problem on his table, which means long-term, China is either going to have to move towards a more liberal system, or the Communist Party is going to lose the mandate of heaven, let's say.
Another alternative, I fear, and it sounds as though it's increasingly being talked up in at least some circles in China, which means presumably with permission, is invasion, a forcible taking of Taiwan to ensure that it indeed does submit to China's will. It is reunified, as the Chinese say, or unified, as the Taiwanese, I guess, I think rather more historically accurately describe it. David, is that something that we should be anticipating, worrying about, and trying to deter?
It's something to worry about. It is an option. But in this case, I think the threat is mightier than the execution. China now has about 100,000 troops, 40,000 Marines, 60,000 mechanized infantry, ready to move across the Taiwan Strait. They have a massive missile force, which could probably deny access to the American Navy. And they have the Russian S-400 air defense system, which can sweep the skies of anything up to fourth generation aircraft. They probably couldn't take down F-35s, but it's not clear how many F-35s we have in the region that could really make a difference. So the physical capability to invade Taiwan is unquestionably there. That is the iron fist inside the velvet glove, and it's a warning to Taiwan that if they move too far, if they establish declaration of independence or too many other countries recognize Taiwan's independence against China, they do have that option, and they're advertising it. Clearly, they would prefer not to use it because China's bid for world dominance is not based on grabbing control of an island, which is already serving their purposes technologically to the maximum. Their bid for world dominance is based on controlling key technologies and rolling people up into the One Belt, One Road infrastructure program, which plans to spend trillions of dollars in the next decade. And they prefer to do it that way. So I see this as a threat, not as an imminent event. But it's obviously something we have to worry about. And we have to worry about the fact that the Chinese have a lot of missiles and a lot of submarines, a lot of good high-tech stuff, satellite-killing missiles, which could make it very difficult for us to defend Taiwan.
And this is the question I guess I have, and one can only put it out there as a question at the moment, is does there come a point where the people who have assembled those military capabilities and add sea lift and airlift to the mix feel so tempted by their position and so concerned about the presence in a really exemplary way of an alternative to the government of China, the totalitarian credit score system, and so on, as to feel that they have to act to snuff it. David, obviously, we're not going to resolve this here. We're going to talk about it in the future, I know, and we'll certainly be watching closely for indications of the possibility, as you say, becoming actualized. But we should do everything we can, I think, safe to say, to deter it. Let me switch gears. There is another topic on which you have recently written, namely about Iran and the fragility of the regime in Iran. We have been hearing a lot of remonstrating with President Trump over his action against Qasem Soleimani, mostly by people who I think are convinced of the permanence of the Iranian regime and the necessity of accommodating them, much as Obama had done notoriously in the past. Tell us why that's not advisable under present circumstances and the evidence that supports that contention.
The Iranian people are in desperate circumstances. In the big cities, a modest apartment, you know, an hour from your work, enough rice to give you 2,000 calories a day and maybe an egg or two a day will eat up the average Iranian salary. A car is out of the question. That would be 14 years of average salary. That's why when last year the regime took off price controls in gasoline doubled and tripled in price, you had riots over it, because any price increase of that kind pushes people over the boundary into malnutrition. Meanwhile, literally thousands of villages are being abandoned because of a lack of water. There's a desperate water crisis in Iran due to 40 years of catastrophic mismanagement by the theocratic regime. The Iranian people are in desperate straits. So you see uprisings against the regime, which have caused the murder in the streets of perhaps 2,000 people. But I would refer to the example of Venezuela, which is even more desperate, despite our best efforts and a good deal of American influence in the country. We've not been able to overthrow that narco-kleptocracy, which runs Venezuela. Desperate poverty is not a sufficient condition for an overthrow of a regime. You actually need a party that's organized, that's ready to take power and appeal to the people. I do not know at this point whether anything like that exists on the ground. And part of the problem is 8 years of the Obama administration have basically destroyed our assets on the ground. I don't think the U.S. intelligence community has strong capabilities available. There's certainly a lot of people we could enlist to oppose the regime, including ethnic minorities, even the Kurds. I think there's 6 million Iranian Kurds are probably the most appropriate. But Baluchistan is certainly another problem, but the Baluchis are not necessarily people. You know, there's a lot of jihadi elements there, which are a little dodgy. I don't think that we have anything in preparation which is likely to overthrow the regime anytime soon. It's obviously something that we should aim for, and it's the kind of thing which in detail should not be discussed on the radio. It should be discussed in the secret councils of the administration. That means, in my view, that we've got an octopus which may be damaged and may be starving, but we've got to keep chopping off its tentacles in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and other places, humiliating them, as we did with the Soleimani assassination, and break them down. It's going to be a grind. It's going to be a war of attrition. It's not going to be a matter of pushing a button and getting a new government in there.
No, I think that's certainly true. And in the end, it's still going to require the Iranian people to enable it. It's not going to be done by external forces. I'm quite confident of that. David, speaking of external forces, just very quickly, you're a serious student of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey. Speaking of jihadist elements, he's dispatching troops to Libya. Does this come as a surprise to you, or is it a matter of particular concern?
The most concerning thing is he did so by agreement with Vladimir Putin. There is now a de facto Russian-Turkish alliance to take control of large parts of the Middle East. There's a Russian-Turkish condominium in Syria where the Russians are supporting the Assad regime and Turkey is supporting various Sunni elements, but they've agreed to carve up territory and limit the infighting. They got together on Libya. That was a joint decision.
They're supporting opposite sides there, though, as I understand it. Is that right?
That's correct, but they still have agreed to a truce. So whatever Erdogan has done is by agreement with Putin. And of course, Erdogan, to the enormous displeasure of the Trump administration, has been buying Russian air defense systems. They've bought the S-400 system. So Erdogan has decided that Russia is the rising power in the Middle East. The United States is the declining power, and he's thrown in with the Russians. The problem we have in the Middle East, Frank, is simply that we don't want to be there, and the Russians do. What we do reluctantly. The Russians do it enthusiastically. So Erdogan has placed his bets on the Russian side.
They have, but it seems to me with the expectation that they too will tire at some point and he will emerge as the rising power in its stead. To be continued. David, thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you do at Asia Times. We are so anxious for your new book. Can't wait to have you back to talk about that in the very near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Roger Robinson about what should come next with respect to China. He's got a 4-point strategy. It all makes sense to me right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a special privilege, I must say, as well as a great honor to have with us one of the men I've come to admire most in Washington, D.C. over the past 40 years for a number of reasons. One, he's become a close personal friend and mentor for many, many of those years, but also because of his service to our country at a critical moment when he served as the Senior Director for International Economic Affairs under President Ronald Reagan and helped the Gipper devise and execute the economic warfare component of the strategy that resulted in the takedown of the Soviet Union. His name is Roger Robinson. For his government service, he was a Vice President of Chase Manhattan Bank and a special assistant to its chairman, David Rockefeller. He has gone on in the years since his government service at the National Security Council to do a number of things, both in the private sector at RWR Advisory Group, as well as the Prague Security Studies Institute, and as a member and actually the chairman for a time of the U.S. Commission on Economic and Security Review Issues with respect to China. He is an extraordinary asset and a great friend, as I said, and I'm delighted always to have him with us, especially for a chance to visit with him at the beginning of 2020 and in the aftermath of the announcement and signing yesterday of the so-called Phase 1 U.S.-China trade agreement, among other things to talk about. So what's Phase 2? Roger Robinson, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, my friend. It is good to have you with us. Happy New Year. Let's start in on your thoughts about Phase 1, first of all, and that set up, if there is one, for a Phase 2.
Well, Frank, there's a lot being talked about here by a wide variety of folks, so we don't need to do much more than just review the bidding. You know, there's going to be $200 billion more in purchases by China over the next 2 years, or at least that's their commitment. I think the president retaining many of the tariffs, even though some were cut in half, is a critical point of leverage. I think it would have been most disheartening to trust them with a wholesale lifting of tariffs, which fortunately did not happen. We took written commitments on intellectual property protection. The same is true with forced technology transfers and government-subsidized enterprises of China that can win anytime, anywhere, at any price, and is clearly one of the most unfair sets of trade practices in the world today. Now, those are words on a page, and China does not excel in adhering to such words. So obviously, one needs to be very concerned. And of course, they got a pass on currency manipulation, at least for now. But I think that this was a valiant effort by the White House. It certainly is going to require feet to the fire, but I think the president's equipped to do that. And I think that the most important thing that has happened here is that trade, for now, is finally off the table. I mean, this, after all, we must remember, is China's agenda. This is the shiny object that they want us to concentrate on. This is the one that they can sustain blows and come out fighting, as has been amply demonstrated. And so, finally, we have a chance to move to Phase 2. And it seems to me that people are going to have different ways in which they speculate or configure Phase 2. I certainly have four central components in mind.
Tell us about him. This is really important because I think all other things being equal, the default setting would be more of the same, you know, more trade discussions. But you've got four agenda items that broaden it out.
Yes, I think that we have to start to control the agenda. I mean, right now, China's controlling the agenda in the sense that although it's terribly important that we've shown this kind of resolve by the president on trade matters, again, we have to remember that they can do this all day long, all month, all, you know, multi-year long without taking too serious a blow. I think we need to go after other areas where they are far more vulnerable and their predations are largely based on, which is, of course, our technology. And that has been stolen on a wholesale basis in the hundreds and hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars. So those controls on our technology transfers in all of their iterations, not just 5G and the more notable ones, need to be strengthened considerably.
Just to drill down on that quickly, that requires more aggressive vetting of the technologies that are being sought by the Chinese and formal decisions by the United States government to decide whether to let them go or not, right?
Yes, I think I heard at least tell that the NSC had even made a proposal that all significant technology transfers to China should now be under license. And that process alone would, of course, require the kind of diligence and scrutiny that you're talking about. I don't know if it'll succeed, but it was a heartening indicator of White House resolve.
So this should be part of a phase two agreement. What's your second item?
Well, the continued decoupling of the two economies, frankly, because as we see China adopting an increasingly adversarial role, and its hostile predations toward the United States continue apace, and if not intensify, its human rights abuses likewise intensify, we need to ensure that they don't have the kind of leverage over us that they are desperately seeking to have, that we need to be able to understand that we may need to live without China if this kind of trend continues much longer.
Now, this is not necessarily something that we would negotiate with the Chinese. This is really a policy that we would be pursuing. But you're just saying it should be the kind of policy ambit within which we are having these conversations with them about trade and other matters, right?
Indeed. I mean, this is our agenda, as they say. And I'm not looking for Chinese concurrence on this, nor should we as a nation. And the third, of course, related to this, is persuading our allies and nations friendly to us to resist this Chinese siren song of big money, big investment promises, often coming to naught, except with huge untenable debt burdens as the legacy, because they often turn out to be a thinly disguised nation capture effort to compromise these countries and put them in effect in their orbit. They do this through their so-called checkbook diplomacy, but many other modalities.
The whole Belt and Road Initiative, I think, really falls into that category, doesn't it? But again, Roger, this is not necessarily something that we would parlay with the Chinese about. This is the kind of thing that ought to be our policy focus, and specifically, you're saying, with respect to the allies. And you've had a lot of experience over the years, going back notably to the Reagan administration, with allies who have been resistant to American leadership in such areas and costing them what they consider to be business opportunities or jobs or whatever else. Based on your experience, what would you advise President Trump to do that he isn't already doing to try to persuade the allies to wean themselves from this delusion that they're going to get rich as a result of doing deals with the Chi-Coms?
Well, persuading and cajoling can only go so far. I'm sorry to say that this is reminiscent of the Soviet Union. When the European allies had a completely different trade philosophy. It was exports and jobs uber alles, if I may say. It put national security and human rights on a distant back burner. The president wasn't going to live with that. He tried the persuasion route, and when that failed, it actually came to sanctioning certain European companies that were still providing supplies and equipment and technology to the Siberian gas pipeline at the time, much like Nord Stream 2 today. So the point being that the administration has done yeoman's work in getting out there to do this in places like Brazil, Germany, UK, and so forth. But look at the trouble that they're encountering. The Germans have stiffed them. The UK is wavering. Brazil is a question mark. In other words, there needs to be a price. If, for example, Huawei is integrated into the 5G architectures of these countries, then they should take a hit in terms of our willingness to cooperate with them in the all-important field of intelligence and intelligence sharing in particular. These are the kinds of costs that should be part and parcel of these kind of discussions, because believe me, it's sad fact but true. The allies and friendly nations sometimes only understand the language of cost and fear. And we have to be in that business, sadly, or China is going to take us to the cleaners every time.
And it's my understanding that that's basically the policy of the Trump administration at the moment. And yet we're seeing, I mean, wavering doesn't quite sound like it's accurate with respect to Boris Johnson's government at the moment. Incredibly, it seems determined, even at the cost of the whole Five Eyes special relationship that we have put on the line if they wind up integrating Huawei into their network for wireless and thereby compromising our confidence in their ability to secure the communications between us.
Right. The allies are testing us. They did not believe that Ronald Reagan had the resolve to impose full import controls, that is, the denial of the entire U.S. marketplace to European companies that continued to supply this vast Soviet project over our objections that was going to make West European dependency on Soviet gas absolutely untenable in the 75% area, and double their hard currency income, et cetera. So the point is, they didn't believe that the president was going to stick by his guns and actually go after them in a serious way, a way that was beyond their ability to sustain themselves if they continued to flout his objections to this. The same kind of test is going on with President Trump. The Brits in particular, they actually came out and said, we don't really believe that there's going to be a cutback in intelligence sharing, whether we take a firm stand on 5G, China, and Huawei or not. This is the kind of thing that the president's going to have to step up to.
Roger, we're going to pause for just a second. When we come back, we're going to talk about the fourth key initiative that needs to be part of American policy going forward in the so-called Phase 2 moment. That and much more with Roger Robinson right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Roger W. Robinson, Jr. He is a longtime Washington hand with extraordinary accomplishments to his credit, notably, but not exclusively, the enabling, really, of the takedown of the Soviet Union with his advice to President Reagan about how economic warfare could be effectively waged against that hostile state, that last totalitarian communist regime that sought our destruction. He has been working for some time now, notably in connection with an institute he founded in the Czech Republic. It also has a Washington office now, the Prague Security Studies Institute, on today's totalitarian communist threat, namely that of the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Republic of China that it misrules. Roger, you've laid out nicely three important initiatives that ought to guide American policy, not so much in terms of negotiating with the Chinese, but in terms of how we position ourselves to deal with the threat that China poses. You've saved, I think, the most important of them for last, the fourth of these initiatives. Tell us about what else President Trump must do if he wishes to counter and hopefully have a similarly effective strategy towards China as the one that you assisted President Reagan in crafting and executing towards the Soviet Union?
Well, Frank, the very last thing that China wants to see in terms of U.S. policy is our taking on the financial dimension. That is to say, the fact is that China has been looking to finance themselves and their enterprises in no small part from 150 to 180 million American investors in our capital markets, in our stock and bond markets. They have probably now over 1,000 enterprises that are receiving such funding in one form or another from the American people, unwittingly, in the case of the non-disclosure element involved here. It is a very serious threat to us, not only the nature of what we're funding and the nature of the companies, which are a laundry list in some cases of bad actors, both in from a human rights and national security points of view, but also the broader issues of how do they maintain this huge defense budget? How can they be a peer competitor to us in weapon systems? How is it that they have seemingly limitless money to move around the world and compromise one country after another into their orbit, into their leverage gambit?
So we've got a situation, Roger, that has already transferred, by some estimates, trillions of dollars from American capital markets to the Chinese. Is it a question of now closing the door after the horse is gone, or is there still more that the Chinese aspire to utilize from our retirement funds and other institutional and individual investors' portfolios in order to do even more harm in the future?
You can be sure that they are determined to maintain unfettered access to our capital markets, which have never been screened for national security and human rights concerns in the history of our markets, which have a dearth of diligence being performed, a similar absence of adequate disclosure. So this is one of the great free lunch programs for China, and in fact, the greatest that they've ever known. And they intend to basically move another, or seek to remove, if you will, or be funded to the tune of $2 to $3 trillion, in my estimation, over the next 24 to 36 months. And that may be lowballing it. And if there is another, say, $3 trillion in their issuances of equities, stocks, and bonds that we're holding, it could be the case that in as little as 2 to 3 years, but probably three, the American people will wake up one morning, and I mean everybody in the markets, 150, 180 million of us, look at our portfolios and realize to our horror that 17, 22, 25 or more percent of our total retirement and investment portfolios are in Chinese securities.
Now, when you say that, Raj, yeah, just let's help people understand. You've mentioned several times a lack of transparency, a lack of due diligence. Set aside for the moment the danger of China being the arbiter of your financial fortunes. What about these companies? You've indicated some of them are engaged in very bad activities from a human rights and national security perspective, but do we have any sense of simply their viability? Like other American participants in our capital markets, is there anything remotely comparable in terms of, say, disclosure of material risk that American firms must meet in order to be able to take money from investors in this country?
Think of the outrage of the fact that we are providing China with preferential treatment in our markets that our American corporate counterparts could only dream about. Do you know that their financials, which have to be reviewed for any kind of rudimentary diligence, are regarded as state secrets and not available? Did you know that there's no auditing of Chinese enterprises by the PCAOB? That is the auditing function that every American firm is subject to ensure that there's some validation of the numbers being real and accurate enough for investors to rely on. What about the fact that they're not compliant with Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley? Even, you know, we're talking about federal securities laws that have been in effect waived for China so that they can waltz in as black boxes and attract these kinds of funds. Now, fiduciarily, this is completely malfeasant. So over and above the fact that we're talking about companies that are purveyors of the surveillance equipment and facial recognition technology and so forth for the concentration camps in Xinjiang that are housing 1.5 to 2.5 million Uyghurs, the collecting of dissident Tibetans at train stations. In other words, these kinds of human rights abuses. But also you have proliferators of weapons of mass destruction. You have serial U.S. sanctions violators. You have South China Sea island builders and those firms that are militarizing those islands. You have the folks that are supplying the missile and nuclear and other capabilities to the North Koreans. You've got known hackers. You've got companies that have been already indicted for espionage. In other words, where is the rudimentary diligence? Where is the SEC utterly missing in action to make sure that these kinds of obvious material risks are being disclosed to the American investor prior to making the investment so that they can make an informed decision, which is the mandate of the SEC?
This is so incredible on so many different levels. It just boggles the mind. But just to pick up on one thing you alluded to there, Roger, and that is that you have companies that it is illegal for us to be doing business with because they are sanctioned by the United States government. And yet it's still possible for them to get money to underwrite their activities from the U.S. capital markets. This simply boggles the mind. And to your point about the fact that we are actually watching our investment, our future retirement funds migrating into these kinds of companies, the black hole, really, of what China is up to, is creating, inevitably, is it not, a China lobby for continued entente, shall we say, or engagement or doing business with China on its terms.
You have Americans that if they realize that 22-25% of their investment portfolios are in Chinese securities, they have a vested financial interest in opposing any future penalties or sanctions against China, independent or irrespective of the severity of the offense, for fear that the value of their investment portfolios will be damaged.
This is a national security problem in addition. Roger, we are hard at the end of our time. There's so much more to talk with you about in this regard, as well as so many others, and I hope you will be back with us often in 2020. But this is, I would argue, the single most important of the issues that you've addressed, all four of which are vital to getting right our posture vis-a-vis communist China. And I can say this as the vice chairman of the Committee on the Present Danger of China. You've made an enormous impact with your briefings to the committee, and I know that it's being heard in the official corridors of Washington. I hope that these four items, and most especially the thrift savings plan and the capital markets initiative that you've helped develop, will be prominently featured in the post-phase one environment. Thank you, my friend, for your time today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.